KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Inner Sunset.
Outer Sunset.
North Beach.
Mill Valley.
Knob Hill.
Berkeley, California.
Berkeley. Albany.
Alameda.
The Presidio.
Coming up, we visit a small school where students haven't been able to drink their water for years.
There's nobody making sure that the small communities have the resources they need to treat their water.
And we'll hear the backstory of two Bay Area teenagers who made national news when one set the other on fire on an Oakland bus.
Both these families managed in times of incredible difficulty to look beyond their own pain and be able to see the humanity in somebody else and to feel their pain and have compassion for them.
That's next today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. In 2012, California became the first state in the nation to recognize the human right to safe, clean, affordable, and accessible water. Governor Jerry Brown signed a law urging all state water agencies to consider this declaration when making future water policy decisions. But 6 years later, in hundreds of communities across the state, the water coming out of some taps is still not drinkable. Many of these places are small and rural, economically disadvantaged. Most are located in the Central Valley, but some are here in the Bay Area, and solutions aren't easy. KALW's environment reporter Angela Johnston takes us to a small school in San Mateo County where students haven't been able to drink the water at their school for decades.
Pescadero is a farm worker town, and the high school is bordered by rows of vegetables that, on most days, end up on the plates of hungry teenagers. But it's this close proximity to Brussels sprouts and kale that means the students here have to go to a cooler to wash their lunch down instead of sipping from the water fountains. The water here has unsafe levels of nitrates, and the source is the fertilizer used on the nearby farms.
I moved here from a bigger school in Belmont at the beginning of my sophomore year, so it was a pretty big surprise to me that I didn't have any like clean water or clean drinking water.
Sophia Bateo is the student body president. She's a senior, and she says most kids are used to it by now.
I mean, I think that just comes with the territory of like living in a small town like this. You don't have as many resources as in like the suburbs or like a bigger city. It's not like so far off to have clean water in when, you know, like it's not like it's a developing area like a third world country is.
Pescadero High School has its own water well that's owned and maintained by the school district. It's one of hundreds of small water systems on a list of water quality violators put together by the State Water Board.
There's a surprising number of communities in California that don't have water that's safe to drink.
Laura Feinstein is a researcher at the Pacific Institute, a water quality think tank. There are nearly 300 small communities on the state's list. Many are in the Central Valley, mobile home parks, or just a few blocks served by a single well. There are also, like Pescadero, tiny schools.
Small water systems tend to struggle more funding the treatment needs to make their water safe to drink. They need to be careful about cooking with the water as well, and it makes things expensive and difficult for them.
Not all violations are created equal. Some communities are flagged because they test high for toxins for just a couple of months. Others have more persistent problems that they can't afford to fix. Feinstein says nobody's dealing with it.
At this stage, there isn't like a safety net. There's nobody making sure that the small communities have the resources they need to treat their water. Does that mean they're on their own? It's their problem? Or does that mean that the state has some kind of obligation to come up with a way to make sure that they can tap into some resources and get safe water to those homes?
Drinking water sources across the state have tested positive for all sorts of harmful chemicals. The two most common are arsenic, which is naturally occurring, and nitrates. In agricultural communities like Pescadero, nitrates often seep into groundwater from fertilizer and cow manure. With prolonged exposure, these chemicals can cause serious health problems, especially for babies and old people. At Pescadero High, students can drink from one of three water coolers. When cook Regina Silvera wants to wash lettuce in the kitchen, She hauls giant water jugs across the floor and attaches a little electric pump to get a constant stream.
We started off with the 5-gallon jugs, and after a while they started getting tiring, so they switched me down to 3 gallons now.
Fixing the problem would mean drilling a new, deeper well, or convincing the nearby water utility to run pipes from miles away. That neighboring utility doesn't want to hook up the school because it's worried their wells will go dry. These should be simple fixes, but for a small school district, it'd be a big undertaking and expensive.
And we all wear a lot of hats here. And so the oversight of a well, it just creates a whole other layer of oversight that, you know, our district can't afford in our budget is really what it boils down to.
Andy Legault is the facilities manager at Pescadero High. He says people are always surprised when he tells them what he's dealing with.
One of the richest counties in the country. And we have schools that the water quality is below standards.
The school is applying for state grants to build the new well, but Legault says they have a long list of projects competing for their time and money. Pescadero is a tiny district that struggles to pay teachers enough to keep up with the cost of living on the peninsula.
It just makes it tough to put it on the top of the list. If you think about a normal school, they just turn the water on. They don't think of, the reality is that's taken care of by somebody else.
This coming year, the legislature will be debating Senate Bill 623, which would help low-income communities like Pescadero High put in new wells or join with larger water systems. Laura Feinstein explains the money would come from two sources. One would be a tax on water bills paid by consumers across the state.
So everyone would pay a small amount every month, and it would go into a fund that would address unsafe drinking water for communities that can't afford their own treatment systems.
But that funding source is facing opposition from the Association of California Water Agencies. Here's Jennifer Allen with the Contra Costa Water District.
We want to make sure that any adjustments to a proposed fee or tax would go through a public process and not just be kind of a closed-door decision.
Water agencies say water is a human right. It shouldn't be taxed.
Whatever we're doing with water, people's water bills, we don't want to affect the affordability of water. And water is necessary. And so our job is to make water as affordable as possible. And when we're getting outside fees that we have to impose upon bills, then that impacts our ability to make our service affordable to our customers.
The bill's other source of money to fix polluted wells would be raising the tax on fertilizer. This would affect nearly every farmer in the state. But agriculture is supportive. Surprisingly, some environmentalists oppose it for a different reason. They're concerned it's a pay-to-pollute scheme that doesn't really solve the nitrate problem in the first place.
We think collectively about our air quality. We think collectively about how we're going to move forward reducing greenhouse gases. I think that we also need to think collectively as a state about making sure everybody gets safe drinking water.
Laura Feinstein says this debate raises a larger point. California is drying up. Water quantity and quality issues aren't going away. If the bill passes, Andy Legault says Pescadero High will definitely apply for the fund. But clean water is at least another year and hundreds of thousands of dollars away. When they can finally drink from their taps, he says they'll be celebrating.
We might have a little party, yes.
In Pescadero, I'm Angela Johnston for Cross Current.
Angela is our environment and energy reporter. You can reach her at environment@klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. You may remember a disturbing incident in Oakland a few years back. Two high school kids on an AC transit bus. One of them set the other on fire. 18-year-old Sasha Fleischman leapt up, their skirt a ball of flame. They survived with the help of two passengers. I use the pronoun they. That's the preferred pronoun for Sasha, who identifies as agender. Legs charred nearly to the bone, Sasha staggered out of the bus in shock and collapsed on the ground. 16-year-old Richard Thomas had flicked the lighter, then slipped off the bus. He was arrested the next day. Reporter Dashka Slater reports this incident in her book, The 57 Bus. It looks into questions of gender identity, class, and juvenile justice, often through the language of the youth themselves. Dashka sat down with KALW's Ben Trefney, who asked her to start by reading an excerpt from the book.
The school day was long over at 5 o'clock, but Carl was still in his classroom when Sasha called him on his cell phone. "Dad, I need you to come over here right now. I was on the bus and I got set on fire." "What?" Carl said. The reception was terrible. "Say it again." "You have to pick me up and take me to the hospital because someone set me on fire." Carl was sure he wasn't hearing right. He walked around his classroom, closing windows and gathering his things. "Wait, say it again. You were on that bus and what happened?" "I need to go to the hospital. Now."
That's Dashka Slater. She's author of the book, The 57 Bus, a true story of two teenagers and the crime that changed their lives. Can you tell us about who Sasha Fleischman and Richard Thomas were on November 4th, 2013?
At the time, Sasha was 18 years old and was and is agender, that is, identifying neither male nor female, and was attending a small private high school. Richard was 16 years old and attended Oakland High School, which is a large public high school in Oakland, and was kind of a class clown, not a very good student, but kind of known for liking to make people laugh, and was living with his mom and stepfather and younger brother in East Oakland, and had recently gotten out of a group home where he had been for about a year.
Up in Redding.
Up in Redding.
Oh, so what happened on the bus that day?
So Richard was coming home from school with an older cousin and ran into another kid that they both knew. Sasha was also on the same bus coming home from school and was asleep. Richard and his cousin and friend were goofing around, and the friend handed Richard a lighter and suggested that he light Sasha's skirt on fire. Sasha's skirt burst into flames. It really looked like a fireball. And Sasha was put out by two bystanders and ended up with second and third degree burns that ran up and down both legs. Spent about 3 weeks at a San Francisco burn center and had to have multiple surgeries and skin grafts and so forth to treat the burns.
And everything that you described there, I mean, this is things that you could see because of video and audio recordings that were on the bus.
That's right.
This was a big story in the Bay Area when it first happened. What made you want to write a book about it?
Well, it started out as an article for the New York Times Magazine. And what drew me to it in the first place was some curiosity about both of the kids on either side of this. I didn't know what the word agender meant when I first heard it, and so I was really intrigued to try and understand what this form of gender expression meant and how Sasha had understood that about themselves. And I was also intrigued with the fact that Richard was 16 years old, was being charged as an adult, and faced the possibility of life in prison. To me, that raised a lot of questions about how do we know whether somebody is irredeemable or not? You know, obviously, Richard had done something terrible at that point. I didn't know anything about his story, but I wanted to know, even if he has these terrible views and is a biased and hateful person, how do we know that at 16, that's all he's going to be?
So you write in a lot of different ways, whether it's articles or children's books or nonfiction books like this. So why did you choose to tell this story as a young adult novel?
From the very beginning, when I was working on it for the New York Times Magazine, I had this fantasy in my mind of writing the same story in a different way for a teenage audience. And at the time, I didn't even know whether such a genre existed of, you know, true crime narrative nonfiction for teens.
And within this book, there are a lot of different chapters, definitely dozens, and they're written in different styles. And I think that's one of the things that's compelling about the way in which you put this book together. Could you read another passage? This one actually is called Tumbling, and it talks about Sasha's self-description on the app Tumblr.
Favorite vegetable, bok choy. Favorite animals, cat and cuttlefish. Favorite type of movie, dream sequences. Three best qualities, navigation, my friends seem to like me, purple. Of course I like hats. Anyone who doesn't is wrong. I like compliments. I dislike compliments. I like my hair. I give good hugs. I'm good at finding potential puns. If the whole world was listening, I might just rant about a bunch of things like gender, wealth inequality, why school is important. I like parties. I dislike parties. I don't really keep track of disappointments. Ideal vacation spot. Probably a city with a nice subway. Thinking of things to get me? Try this. A brass airship, a transit map shower curtain, a medieval cloak, a corset with silver buttons, a chiseled chunk of gallium that melts in your palm, a dress swirled with the image of a nebula, a Victorian house on wheels, tights painted like a mermaid tail.
That's Dashka Slater. She's author of the book, The 57 Bus, a true story of two teenagers and the crime that changed their lives. You also have a letter from Richard. So one of the ways in which you tap into his psyche is to share a letter that he wrote to Sasha after the incident happened. Would you mind reading that as well?
Sure. November 8, 2013. Dear victim, I apologize for my actions, for the pain that I brought to you and your family. I was wrong for what I did. I was wrong. I had no reason to do that to you. I don't know what was going through my head at that time. I'm not a monster. I have a big heart. I never even thought of hurting anyone like the way I hurt you. I just wanted you to know that I'm deeply sorry for my actions. I think about what happened every second. I pray that you heal correctly and that you recover and live a happy life. Please forgive me. That's all I want. I take responsibility for all my actions. I'll take all the consequences. I wish you and your family the best of luck. I'm not just saying this because I'm incarcerated. I honestly mean every word. Love, Richard.
What happened with that letter?
So that letter and one that was written afterwards were given to Richard's attorney, William Dubois, and he put them in his briefcase and held on to them because they contained admissions of guilt. He didn't feel like he could pass them on until after the case had been adjudicated. And so they stayed with him for 14 months.
And the strategy for Dubois, he said, was that he thought that it admitted guilt, and so therefore to share that during the trial process wouldn't have been a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we have an adversarial legal system, and so the system that we have doesn't allow for somebody to admit they did a crime without that having potentially great consequences. And Richard, at that point, was facing life in prison, and so it was just too big of a risk.
Because Sasha's family also didn't necessarily want to prosecute him the way in which the prosecutors wanted to. That's something that you discuss, is that Nancy O'Malley, who is the DA of Alameda County, ended up deciding to try to prosecute Richard as an adult, even though he was 16 at the time. But Sasha's family wasn't necessarily interested in that. And I really feel like that's something that comes through in this, that it did not seem to me that you thought justice was really served in the proper way.
I felt that justice was very difficult to reach in the context in which everybody was working. Sasha's family was very clear from the outset that they didn't know anything about Richard. They did not want to make a call about what should happen to him or what kind of kid he was, but they did feel that he was a juvenile and should be treated as a juvenile.
Do you think about what Sasha would have been like if they were born into Richard's community or if Richard had been born into Sasha's community?
Oh, absolutely. I think that one of the things you really feel in the book is that Sasha was incredibly lucky to have the parents that they have, who both have the resources and the understanding and the, you know, kind of compassion and just, you know, who they were as people to really help Sasha be the person that Sasha was interested in being. And, you know, by the same token, Richard has a very supportive family who really also advocated for Richard throughout his life, but had many more challenges economically, had a father who was incarcerated, had, it's pretty clear, some undiagnosed learning challenges that had they been treated, you know, might have, you know, created a different path for him. And so I think you really do see the ways in which, you know, paths are easier for some kids, and a lot of that has to do with economics.
And often with race.
And often with race.
Are there any final takeaways you have now, having put this book together and gotten to know these people so well?
My main takeaway, and the one that I hope people will get from reading the book, is just how much capacity for grace there is in even the worst moments. Both these families managed in times of incredible difficulty to look beyond their own pain and be able to see the humanity in somebody else and to feel their pain and have compassion for them. And, you know, to me, that's something to be emulated for all of us.
That was reporter and author Dashka Slater talking with KALW's Ben Trefney about her latest book, The 57 Bus. That interview was produced by Christine Nguyen. To find more about the book, head to our website, kalw.org, and click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. We're going to end today's show with a story from our friends at Youth Radio. In our last segment, we heard about an incident that took place on the 57 bus in which high schooler Richard Thomas set 18-year-old Sasha Fleischman's skirt on fire. Sasha identifies as agender and goes by the preferred pronoun they. In this audio essay, reporter Desmond Megley takes a deeper look at the use of the singular they and why it matters.
When I tell someone my preferred pronouns are they, them, there, I never know what to expect. Sometimes people just say, okay. Other times, they'll ask a whole bunch of questions I don't really feel like answering. For example, you look like a boy. Why use they instead of he? Answer, I look like me. That's all there is to it. When people make assumptions about me based on the clothes I'm wearing or whether or not I'm wearing makeup, that's on them. It has nothing to do with who or what I actually am. Example 2. How can one person be a they? It doesn't make sense. Answer, it's really simple. In English, we already use singular they all the time. Suppose you found 50 bucks on the ground. You might say, oh, someone dropped their money here. That's singular they. It dates back to at least the 16th century. And most major dictionaries, from Oxford to Webster's, consider it to be grammatically correct. That should be enough. What bothers me most is when I tell someone several times to use they-them pronouns for me, but they make no effort to do so. Being ignored like that hurts. When I come out to people, it means I trust them. If they value my trust, they should respect who I am, including my gender pronouns. I don't always feel safe correcting others, and I don't like repeating myself to someone who isn't listening. But my silence isn't permission to keep ignoring my preferences. Seriously, stop doing that. Lastly, it's okay if you get my pronouns wrong by accident. It takes time to adjust to new ways of speaking and thinking. Just don't make it my problem when you misgender me. Getting really apologetic or changing the subject to how difficult you find my pronouns makes me feel super uncomfortable. Don't tell me you're trying. Show me by correcting yourself and moving on. I hope this clears some things up.
That was reporter Desmond Megley for Youth Radio. To find more of their work and stories just like this one, go to youthradio.org. And that's it for our show today. Our team includes Raquel Maria Dillon, Angela Johnston, Truk Nguyen, Lilia Vega, and Josh Wilson. Our engineers are Jackie Sajiko and James Rollins. The line producer is Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by Devotionals. They're playing a benefit show tomorrow at San Francisco's Elbow Room. It's for 16-year-old Bayview resident Rory White, who was struck by a stray bullet last year. Devotionals will be joined by the rock outfit Down and Outlaws, and the show starts at 7:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.